Good afternoon and welcome to today's program brought to you by the Commonwealth Club, Silicon Valley, and National Semiconductor. My name is Jeanette Morgan, Senior Director and Vice President of Global Government Affairs here at National Semiconductor Corporation. It is my pleasure to introduce Dan Walters, Sacramento Bee political columnist. Over the past 40 years, Dan has written over 6,000 articles about California politics. And I'm sure, Dan, all of our inquiring minds want to know what was the most interesting topic you wrote about. Dan began his career at the Sacramento Union, where at the age of 22, he was the nation's youngest daily newspaper editor. In 1981, he began writing the state's only daily column devoted to California's political, economic, and social issues, and 4 years later moved to the Sacramento Bee. His column now appears in more than 50 newspapers throughout California. Dan is the founding editor of the California Political Almanac, author of The New California, Facing the 21st Century, and co-author of The Third House, Lobbyists, Money, and Power in Sacramento. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Dan Walters.
Well, thank you very much, and I apologize for sitting down, but my right leg gave out on me this morning for some reason. It makes me feel old. Just walking through my grandson's school in San Francisco, and suddenly it just buckled on me. I don't know if it was a muscle spasm or what. Whatever it is. Anyway, I don't think I can stand up for that long, so I'm sitting down today. Well, as a matter of fact, I was in San Francisco not only this morning but last night, and went to the Bohemian Club and listened to Kevin Starr, who's a preeminent historian of California, an old friend of mine, talk about his latest book. And Kevin told me, and actually told the audience, as a matter of fact, that whenever he gets too optimistic about California, he reads one of my columns. And so I guess that's what I'm talking about today is, it's California. You know, the governor every year delivers what they call a state of the state message, and it's usually a kind of political pablum of all one kind. I shouldn't say that because Kevin helped write it this year, but it isn't really the state of the state. It's really his political agenda and so forth. So I want to deliver a little state of the state. Now, what is the state of California? And as we head into the second decade of the new millennium. And I have to say, and maybe that's why Kevin made that remark last night, that the state of the state isn't very good. We all see the superficial aspects of that in the worst recession since the Great Depression, with unemployment officially over 12%. And when you add in the people who have dropped out of the labor force or are underemployed or whatnot, we're really talking about more like probably close to 20%. 20% of the potential workers of California today are unemployed or underemployed. And that manifests itself all across the board. One little factoid kind of illustrates that. Only a few years ago, we were buying, and automakers were selling, more than 2 million new cars in California every year. Last year, it was 1 million. That's the lowest level of new car sales in California since 1975. When we had about two-thirds the population we have now, less than two-thirds. And that's just one of many. And we all know about the housing meltdown and all the reverberating effects of that. This is a serious economic recession. And really one of the things we have to ask ourselves in California is whether this is just a recession, certainly part of a nationwide, maybe even global recession, and we'll be coming back like always in another year or two, or maybe this is something more permanent. You know, Michigan used to be the kind of the center of the technological universe at one time. And so the real question is, are we just California and going through another one of our economic cycles, or are we destined to become Michigan on the left coast of America? It's a very serious question. There's no guarantee about that. And if you look back at the most recent economic history of the state, it's a history of boom and bust. Booms caused by people injecting large amounts of capital into the state, tremendous amounts of capital. In the 1980s, it was the Pentagon, putting tremendous amounts of money into California for the so-called Reagan military buildup. And then that went bust with the end of the Cold War. And then in the 90s, it was this area, Silicon Valley, tremendous amounts of venture capital, the dot-com boom that went bust about 10 years ago. And then we saw another injection, tremendous amount of capital flowing in from global banking based on a somewhat shaky premise, as we now know, into the housing market, which exploded in California during this decade and then went bust. So those are all, they all have a similarity. Tremendous amounts of capital flows in, an overexuberance, and then it goes bust. The bubble bursts and leaves kind of wreckage in its wake. Now, we kind of assume that this is going to happen again. I'm not sure it should happen again because it has a kind of a corrosive impact on the larger society. But we kind of assume, well, okay, but something else will happen. Will it be green technology? Will it be biotechnology? Will it be what? We don't know. We just assume it's going to happen. But there really is there's some question as to whether it's going to happen. The question is whether California is competitive globally anymore in this global economy. We know that we have a high cost structure. Even with the housing bust, our housing costs are high. We know that we have a relatively high wage structure. We know that we have a fairly high regulatory and tax structure. And we also should know that our infrastructure is falling apart. We not only have the worst traffic congestion of any state in the United States, but something even in a way more telling than that is we have the nation's second worst pavement conditions. Pavement conditions. If you drive extensively out of California, which I do because my wife and I have been doing the whole country about five states at a time, and you drive back into California, it's a jarring experience. Literally, a jarring experience. And it's just, it's inexplicable to me why states with less personal income, worse weather, have better highways than we do in California. We have just allowed our highway system, and part of that is that congestion. We have a tremendous load of traffic on our roadways. Tremendous. And we don't spend what we need to spend on maintenance, reconstruction. I mean, they're brutal. They are brutal. Only New Jersey has worse pavement conditions, according to the federal government, than California. It's not something we should emulate very well. Our public school system is, what is it? Nobody knows. It's a mess, whatever it is. We have kids from jillions of ethnic and cultural backgrounds in a system that's underfunded, tremendously, I mean, we're tied for last in the country in fourth grade reading scores. That's nothing to be proud about. We have a terrible high school dropout rate. It's at least one-fourth, probably more like one-third. There's some dispute over the numbers, but the people who have really looked into this thing who professionally I think it's more like a third. In Los Angeles Unified School Districts, 50% of the kids never make it through high school. 50%. And there are some other school districts that are just as bad. And that should be disturbing to us. And that's a potential economic turnoff in our global competition. Our college systems are still good. We have globally famous, rightfully so, college systems. But how much longer? How much longer will that thing? Because they're getting squeezed like everything else. Underlying all of these, whether it's traffic or the schools, colleges, everything is, I think, these are just symptoms of the larger malaise. And the larger malaise is what I have called in print a number of times, the crisis of governance. The crisis, the water crisis, the education crisis, the traffic crisis, the budget crisis are all symptoms of a crisis of governance, a chronic and growing inability of California to govern itself. And it doesn't matter, I believe, who governor is, what party's in control. It's a structural problem. It's a structural malady. What's happened and this is my own theory. I mean, I can't offer you any proof other than a half a century of observation. But I believe that what happened is that we basically outgrew the structure of government that we created in the 19th century, that, like other states, we adapted it from the federal system that was created in the 18th century. Now, think about that from your history textbooks. The American structure of government was born out of revolution, from a revolution against a despotic king. So the founding fathers, they were all men, or George Washington was never a father, but that's another story. The founding fathers were suspicious of power. They did not want another king. They wanted to diffuse power. There was a very strong states' rights movement at the time. You remember the original Articles of Confederation were just basically a confederation of states. They weren't really in those of a nation. And that states' rights thing manifested itself in a structure of government that was aimed at diffusing power. Two-house legislative system. Something has to go through both houses. Multiple committees within those houses. An executive. The president has to sign any bill that comes his way. If he rejects it, it's rejected unless he's overridden. And, of course, then eventually the court system gets weighs in on all major issues as to whether they're constitutional or not. Diffusion of power. Nobody really can call the shots. Nobody can just command. And, you know, we debate this to this day. I mean, many of the debates of the recent years in national politics has been over whether the Bush White House acquired too much power, whether there weren't sufficient checks and balances. So it's a continuing debate for this nation is how do you allocate authority? We in California, as I said, adopted that system in 1850 when we became a state. And we then added to it. We were even more suspicious of power. So we added all sorts of additional checks and balances to the system eventually, things like the initiative, the referendum, the recall, two-thirds votes on budgets and spending and taxes, and separately elected departments. I mean, the attorney general doesn't work for the governor. He's a separately elected official. Even the tax board that administers the tax system is not answerable to the governor. They are independently elected. So we diffuse authority even more. We made it even more difficult to make decisions because we were suspicious of concentration of authority. And a good example of that is what I mentioned earlier, the public education system. Can anybody in this room tell me who's in charge of public education in California? You can't, because no one is, or more appropriately, everyone is, and therefore no one is. The governor plays a big role. His secretary of education, who just resigned this week, by the way, the superintendent of public schools, separately elected, has a role. The state school board, appointed by the governor, supposedly advises the secretary or the superintendent of schools, plays a role. They make a lot of educational policies. The legislature certainly plays a role. They decree this, that, and the other, particularly money, but also matters of curriculum, how many days in the school year, all this kind of stuff. Local school boards don't have as much authority as they used to once after Proposition 13. Local superintendents, county school boards, county superintendents. If anything good happens, they all step up. Doesn't happen very often, unfortunately. Anything bad happens, get a new batch of bad test scores, new report on dropouts. Not me, it's that other guy over there. We have a wonderful system for passing the buck. We in California have created this perfect system for passing the buck. We have no system for accountability. No one's in charge of anything. No one is accountable for anything. Now, that worked kind of more or less when we were still at a sparsely populated agrarian monoculture, as you think about it, the United States was when all this was originally created back in the late 18th century, when only white male landowners could vote. But as California became more diverse in its sociological makeup and its economy, and that's really a phenomenon of the last 3 decades particularly. This system started to fall apart. What happened? Well, it's this way. And this is the practical effect of our 18th or 19th century structure of government in a 21st century society. We have needs. We have common issues to be resolved. Traffic congestion. Should we build more highways? Should we fix the ones we got? Should we build mass transit systems? We have a transportation crisis in California. Education, so on and so forth. Water, you've heard them all. I just listed most of them. And they go on year after year without being resolved. Why? Because that diffusion of power makes it almost impossible to make decisions. As a practical matter, what happens is this. You have an issue. It doesn't matter what it is because the dynamics are similar. Even the state budget, very similar. And you have all of these stakeholder groups. That's what the term of art is used in Sacramento, stakeholders. Stakeholders meaning what? People have a stake in the outcome. They may have a financial stake or a political stake or a cultural stake. And they have their lobbyists and representatives to represent their viewpoints in the Capitol. And the more complicated and intractable the issue, the more stakeholders there are. Think of water, for example. I mean, there are literally hundreds of stakeholders in water. Healthcare, literally hundreds of stakeholders in healthcare. So the idea is you're trying to fix a policy. You're trying to create a new policy. You're trying to solve the problem. And all the stakeholders come in and say, well, we think you ought to do this. And all of those we think you ought to do thises conflict with one another. So how do you resolve that conflict? Well, in theory, you know, traditional theory is, you simply look for the consensus. You look for the majority or something like that, assuming that that consensus majority works in a technical sense. But you can't do that. You can't do that. Why? Because of all of those checks and balances. Everybody in that room, every stakeholder of any import whatsoever, has the power to stop anything from happening. And you've probably seen this at the local level as well. Somebody says, let's build such and such. And you say, not in my backyard, you're not. And then you start years, decades of protracted battles until the thing just basically dies of old age. And that's exactly the syndrome you see in Sacramento. Even more stakeholders, more complications, and more certainty that anyone left out of the product can kill it. And so then, what it really means is that on any major decision, policy issue, you have to have not consensus, not majority rule, but unanimity. Well, you can't get unanimity. It doesn't exist on most of these things. Or you keep tweaking the product and tweaking it and tweaking it and tweaking it until you do get that unanimity. But in the process of tweaking it, you'll more often than not create an unworkable monstrosity. I'll give you an example. It happened in 1996 when every single member of the legislature voted for an energy deregulation plan that everybody said was going to be nothing but wonderful. It was going to lower everybody's power rates. It was just going to be just peachy keen wonderful. All the stakeholders had signed off on it. The utilities, the consumer groups, the energy generators, the energy brokers, all the groups and multiple sub-factions within all of those had signed off on it. It was presented to the legislature in the dead of night, saying, take it or leave it. They took it unanimously. Both houses of the legislature voted for it. No one got up to say, will this thing really work? They were assured that, don't ask any questions. We've looked at it. Everybody's. The only thing that was important to them was everybody had signed off on it, not whether it would actually work or what the worst-case scenario is. What's the downside risk? Nobody asked the question. Nobody wanted to ask the question because everybody, the stakeholders, had signed off on it because they had all been given something. Well, you know that you can't give away 110% of something, can't you? They had given away 110% of something. And a few years later, when the energy markets did not perform, in other words, when the underlying assumptions of this wonderfulness turned out to be untrue, the whole thing collapsed. Pacific Gas and Electric Company went into bankruptcy. Southern California Edison almost went into bankruptcy. And we will be paying billions of dollars for it forever. Well, you will. I'm smud, so I don't have to pay for it. Well, that was a unanimous thing. They got it all. They got all the stakeholders there. The state budget every year is the same way. It is functionally impossible to balance the state budget. It cannot be done. You cannot satisfy all of the stakeholders who insist upon satisfaction. You cannot satisfy all the demands for money. You cannot satisfy all the Republican demands for not raising taxes. It cannot be done. And even when the economy was perking along 4 or 5 years ago, it couldn't be done, much less in the middle of this worst recession. Right now, the state of California has, on paper, promised to spend about $105 to $110 billion a year in its general fund budget. That's general fund. That's not DMV or Caltrans. That's the general fund. That's welfare, prisons, schools, health care, and so forth, higher education. $110 billion is the baseline budget. That's what's on paper that we have promised to spend. The baseline revenues this year are going to be about $85 billion. That's with the temporary tax increase that was voted for a year ago. Once you take that off next year, then the baseline revenues are $80 billion maybe, no more than that. But we still have on paper that we're committed to spend $110 billion. And that's why you have a budget crisis. We have committed ourselves to spending more. Now, if the economy was doing well, the gap would be more like 110 versus 100. When the economy is not doing well, then it's 110 versus 80 or something like that. But even if the economy was doing well, they've still promised to spend more than the revenue system of California can generate. And so we have this structural budget crisis. And you can only be closed if you reduce that baseline spending and or you increase the baseline revenues. The legislature isn't capable of doing either on any kind of permanent basis. So you have a temporary tax increase, you have temporary spending cuts, you have deferrals, you have borrowings from general fund. You know, the state general fund owes the special funds, the highway fund and all these other places, about $20 billion that they've kind of borrowed through the back door over the years, then with a vague promise to pay it back sometime. One reason we have bad highways, as a matter of fact. They can't get there from here. They cannot do it. It cannot be done with this structure. We have created this structure, and we've added more to it. We, you know, term limits and gerrymandered districts, and they just made a bad situation worse. They didn't. That's not the bad situation. They just made it a little bit worse. Created even less long-term vision and even less accountability. So what we really need to do, if truth be known, is we need to rebench not only in the financial sense of our state budget, but rebench in a political sense, in that we need to realign our structure of government with what we are as a society. We're not going to change that society. California is what it is and what it's going to be. It's going to have X number of people. We've got about 38 million now, and we'll be 50 million probably by 2030. It's going to continue to be an extremely diverse society with no ethnic majority. It's going to continue to be a very complicated, diverse economy with no central point. So we're not going to change what California is or is going to be. The only thing you can do is change the structure of governance to align itself with that. And what do we need? What do I mean by that? We need to create a system that puts in place what we lack, authority and accountability. We need to empower those we elect to office to make decisions so they cannot pass the buck, and we need to hold them accountable for the decisions they make and not pass the buck. We have exactly the opposite today, and we're reaping the fruits of that in a very negative sense. Do we need a constitutional convention? Probably we do, because I think it's probably the only possible way that you could get there from here. That's no guarantee that a constitutional convention would work. It could be subject to the same kind of wheel spinning that you see in the legislature. But it's probably the only possible way that it could happen. because you cannot amend the Constitution sufficiently. And let me digress for a moment. Our Constitution has almost a self-defeating feature to it. You can amend the Constitution by ballot measure, by initiative ballot measure. If you want to revise the Constitution, which means restructuring things, it can only be done by a constitutional convention or a constitutional revision commission, both of which are controlled by the legislature, which is not likely to change much. So there probably is going to be on the ballot this year. They're collecting signatures now for two ballot measures, one that would change, would amend the Constitution to allow voters to call a constitutional convention, and a second measure that would call such a convention. There is a lot of controversy about it, a lot of incipient opposition to it, people with the fear of the unknown, people who have power under the current system don't want to lose that power. But if California is not to continue down the path of self-destruction, which the transportation systems falter even more, when our water problems get worse, when our other environmental problems get worse, when our education system goes down the tubes, when our economy eventually goes down the tubes because of all those things, then we're going to have to be willing to take a leap into the unknown and go for something like a constitutional convention in the hope that it can restructure government. So the next question that comes up is, what kind of government? Well, I don't know. All I know is this one doesn't work, and there are other alternatives that have been working in other places. Why not a parliamentary system, for example? What's magic about using the federalist system just because it's been used for a couple of hundred years? Maybe it doesn't work anymore in a place like California. Maybe we ought to think about a parliamentary system in which a parliamentary head of government has more authority, like the Prime Minister of England or the Premier of Canada. Maybe we ought to think about a one-house legislature so we wouldn't have all this jockeying back and forth between the legislature. You eliminate some of these checks and balances. Maybe we need a larger legislature, maybe 300 people rather than – we have this one of the smallest legislatures with the biggest population of any state in the United States. Those districts are immense. We haven't changed the size of the legislature since 1860. If it's right then, it couldn't be right now. We have state senate districts that stretch from Oregon to the San Francisco suburbs. It just doesn't make any sense. So maybe we need 300 people in the legislature, only one house of the legislature. Maybe we need, instead of trying to stuff the diversity of California into two political parties, maybe we should have three or four political parties, or five or six. It works other places. It could work here. Maybe we just have outgrown the system of government that we created 160 years ago. And if we don't do something about it, the alternative is continued decay of our infrastructure, of our civic institutions, and increased irrelevancy of our government. And on that happy note, I'd be happy to entertain some questions.
Thank you, Dan, for sharing your jarring insights regarding California with us. We have a number of questions for you, so I'm going to begin with, what states are better governed than California?
Probably all of them, but but it doesn't make any difference because there's no other state like California. This structure of government probably works really well in North Dakota or South Dakota or Idaho or someplace where there's kind of a monoculture, where there's a shared sense of kind of a consensus of social values and cultural values. It probably works fairly well in those places. But when you get a place like California, which is not only a nation state, it's almost a continental state in terms of its diversity, I think it's just you can't really compare it to any place else. You have to really compare it to other countries rather than other states because we're just not like any other state.
We have several questions regarding who could possibly be the next governor of California. So starting with the first, given your 40 years as a journalist, who do you think was California's...
Actually, almost 50 years now.
Ooh.
Be 50 years later this year.
That's fabulous. Congratulations.
Yeah, I guess.
National Semiconductor is also 50 years old. So given your 40 years as a journalist, almost 50, who do you think was California's best governor to date?
Well, I don't know all of them, obviously. Actually, I'm probably going to go out on a limb, and I think that Pete Wilson was the best governor we've had in recent years. And I'll tell you why. Because Pete wasn't exactly a sparkling personality, but he had a great sense of duty. I mean, he really tried to govern California. He wasn't particularly successful at it, in part because of bad luck. No governor has ever had more disasters happen on his watch than Pete Wilson. I mean, it became a joke around the Capitol. Up until now, the worst recession in California history. Fires, earthquakes, riots. I mean, it was just nonstop. And he never could get the kind of traction. He really wanted to have a very positive sort of reform, kind of a Tory reformist, if you know what I mean by that. But he could never even get going on it because it was just nonstop crisis manager. But I will give him credit for this. He basically said, okay, this is the hand that's dealt me. I'll make the best of it I can. And I didn't agree with all of the things he did, but he really tried to govern California. He really understood what the state needed and had great ambitions to try to provide it. Just circumstances prevented it from happening. But I think he was the most diligent governor, at least, of the ones that I've had experience with.
Terrific. Also in that line of thinking with regards to past gubernatorial candidates and governors, you began your career in California as Jerry Brown began his governorship. Do you expect to see him in Sacramento again? And if not, or if so, who would be your ideal candidate?
Well, if I have an idea. I don't think the ideal candidate's running this year, but...
that might
Well, I have to say, I have to separate out into two answers. It's really a two-part question, whether you realize it or not. Personally, I'd love to see Jerry as governor again. Why? Because he was a very interesting guy. And it would be nonstop entertainment, and it would make writing a column a breeze for 8 years. And I have, having been through his first, not only his first governorship, but multiple unforgettable trips around the country on his various presidential excursions, it would be fun to have Jerry back as governor. It would just be fun. And I kind of envision in 2018, 80-year-old Jerry Brown will finally hang it up, and 75-year-old Dan Walters will have the last word on it. But does that mean he is the best possible governor? No. I'm not. I think that the next governor, whoever he or she is doomed to failure. That he or she will inherit such an enormous budget crisis, worse than the one it is right now, because those temporary taxes are going to expire just as the next governor comes in the door. Worse than the one they have now, unless the economy shows a dramatic turnaround, which it shows absolutely no signs of doing. The next governor is doomed to failure. They'll just be allocating pain and more pain and the gimmicks are running out, and you get to that point. I mean, you think about the current governor's budget, unless he gets $7 billion of the federal money, which probably isn't going to happen. He talks about completely eliminating welfare, completely eliminating in-home health care, completely eliminating healthy families programs for children, completely eliminating. There would be no more wealth. You know, California has 32% of all the welfare cases in the country. He would wipe out welfare entirely. And so you're already into doomsday scenarios, and that's with having the money from these temporary tax increases. The next governor is going to have a disaster. I mean, Jerry Brown takes the attitude, which is kind of amusing. You might as well elect me as governor because I'm 71 years old. I got nothing to lose, and I ain't not doing anything else after this. Which is as good a rationale as any. I mean, certainly not ignorant of the issues. When Mae Whitman announced as governor, I wrote a column that said something to the effect that anybody who runs for governor of California ought to undergo a psychiatric examination. And Matt Lauer quoted that column to her on the Today Show, and she didn't have an answer for it, really. But who should be governor? My worst enemy should be governor, whoever that may be. It would serve them right.
Don't think we'll have many people running for governor in this room today. In your opinion, if it is not Governor Brown, which slate of Republican candidates do you think would be best for governor?
Well, I don't make choices of who should be best governor. I just criticize what they do. I honestly don't know that. I think that I haven't heard any realism about from either one of them, or from Jerry Brown, for that matter. None of them has actually offered anything approaching a realistic prescription for this budget, which is not the only problem California has, but is the most obvious one. I mean, Meg Whitman talks about, I'm going to lay off X number of state employees, 40,000 or whatever the number is. So what? That's a drop in the bucket. All but a tiny percentage of the state general fund is spent by somebody else, not by the state of California. It goes to schools, it goes to colleges, it goes to counties for health and welfare programs. The most money the state spends is in prisons. That's about 10% of the state budget. And that's the largest state-only expenditure. And the idea that you're going to lay off 40,000 state employees and somehow balance the budget is ridiculous. Most state employees aren't even part of the general fund. They work for Caltrans and the Department of Motor Vehicles and places like that that have nothing to do with the general fund. So that's just patently stupid. Poizner comes along and says he's going to solve the whole problem by cutting taxes. And Jerry Brown says he's going to solve the whole problem. Well, maybe I will, maybe I won't, but elect me and I'll give it a try. So I haven't heard any realism from any of them, because the realism is so politically daunting. Are you going to run for governor and says, first thing I'm going to do as governor is wipe out welfare. First thing I'm going to do as governor is empty the prisons. First thing I'm going to do as governor is raise all your taxes. And yet they would have to do those things, something along those lines, to actually balance this budget. So of course none of them wants to admit reality. And they're smart people. They know what the situation is. Meg Whitman knows that you can't just lay off 40,000 state employees and solve the budget problem. She knows that. She's not stupid. Steve Poizner knows you can't just cut taxes and that'll solve the budget problem. That he knows that's stupid. And Jerry Brown knows too. He doesn't really want to talk about it because he knows it's so daunting. So I haven't heard any realism from any of them, to tell you the truth, because the reality is so politically daunting. They don't want to touch it with a 10-foot pole. What they'll do, let me tell you how the campaign will be like. Meg Whitman will say Steve Poizner is a devil reincarnate. Steve Poizner will say Meg Whitman's a devil reincarnate. They've got lots of money. They'll spend on Oppo research. They'll pick out every little thing in their background, and they'll go and they'll appeal to the right wing of their own party, because those are the people who vote in primary elections. And they'll lock themselves into positions that have nothing to do with governing in California. And Jerry Brown will try to float into the governorship by saying nothing, basically, of substance. He'll just say, I'm not them, so vote for me. That's it. And so the campaign is going to be a exercise in total unreality, but there is a reality, and the reality is the state is on the verge of insolvency. It can't go bankrupt under federal law, but it can be insolvent. And it's almost, and we were issuing IOUs last year. That's insolvency. We're probably going to issue IOUs this year. That's insolvency. We have billions of dollars in debts, money taken out of special funds that they have no plans to repay. That's insolvency. That's basically theft. They do stuff on this state budget that if they were working for this company or any other company, they would be going to jail. Phantom revenues. The governor says, here's a balanced budget. Well, it only takes $7 billion of federal money. We're going to get it. Phantom revenues, low-balled expenditures. I mean, it's ridiculous. It defies rationality. And you have three intelligent people running for governor who pretend that this reality doesn't exist. It's part of this, it's like schizophrenia or something. It's just really weird.
You've mentioned some of the candidates, and another question we have is, what do you think of the wealthy GOP candidates running for office with their use of their own funds and the fact that they chased out Tom Campbell?
Well, I don't have any problem with people using their own money to run for office. Actually, it shows a certain level of commitment. And it's the only way they could run, frankly. I mean, one of the other inanities we've done is is impose a limit on campaign contributions to candidates not only for governor but for legislature and other offices, with gigantic loopholes in them that says you can have so-called independent expenditures. Well, it's just ludicrous. And the only way you can logically do this is either have independent expenditures that you supposedly have no control or no contact with, underwritten by various interest groups, or you use your own money. Well, given those choices, I just assume they use your own money, frankly. Now, there's no downside to that from the public standpoint. The downside of it, oddly enough, is political. Number one, some people resent you using your own money because they're rich, and people don't like rich people, some people. And there's also the downside is it makes them lazy. Because they don't have to go out and hustle money, they tend to load up their staffs with all these high-powered consultants, and the consultants just love so-called self-finance candidates because they can spend money like it's going out of style. They never have to worry about raising it. They can get all this lavish money and lavish offices and have a great old time, and it tends to make candidates kind of arrogant and lazy by not having to go out and press the flesh and raise money. But from the public standpoint, I don't think it makes any difference. And in fact, you can argue that it's not a bad thing that people spend their own money.
We have one last question regarding gubernatorial candidates. Who do you think would be a good governor that isn't a candidate today?
As I said before, I think the next governor is doomed, whoever he or she is. I don't think it makes any difference who the next governor is, frankly. If nothing else, Arnold Schwarzenegger's governorship has kind of proven that. I mean, here's a guy who came into the governorship with all these advantages of celebrity and, you know, middle-of-the-road politics and didn't owe anybody anything, just was him. And he believed he could govern California. He honestly did. He was wrong for all the reasons I mentioned earlier. And if someone with bringing all those attributes to the governorship cannot only doesn't succeed, but actually falls deeper into the abyss, that should tell you it's not the identity of the governor that's the issue or who controls the legislature. It is the structure of government, that we have a government that does not mesh with what we are as a society. And as long as we don't change that, it really, honest to God, does not make any difference who the next governor is. It could be Dumbo, you know, an elephant, and it doesn't make any difference. Pretty much the same would happen whether it doesn't matter. It really doesn't matter.
Dan, apparently we have some optimists in the room. And the next question is, we know that currently California is a doom and gloom place. Within the last year, has there been anything or anyone positive coming out of Sacramento? Bills, politicians?
Well, there are some people who think that the water bill that was passed last year is a positive thing. I tend to disagree. I think it's going to collapse. I think the voters will turn down the bond issue, and once the bond money is not there, the whole thing will just kind of collapse of its own weight. It's one of those efforts to try to get everybody aboard. Well, they didn't get everybody aboard. There's going to be significant opposition to it. The agricultural community is divided. The environmental community is divided. And I think in that set of circumstances, also with the state of the economy and the generally sour outlook of voters, I think it's very problematic whether they'll approve that bond issue. It's a huge bond issue, and we can't afford it. And we already have many more bonds that have been approved by the voters than Wall Street was willing to buy from us, with the lowest credit rating of any state in the United States. So I think it's almost kind of like whistling in the wind. But that's the most positive thing that's happened of late. Seriously. You cannot overstate the depths of our civic despair in California. And it permeates the Capitol. Those people know it. They know that only about 13% of the voters approve of them. They know that they're despised. They know that if there's measures on the ballot to punish them in some way, go back to a part-time legislature or whatever, the voters will probably buy it because they're so unpopular. And frankly, they don't do much to raise that popularity. They're stuck in this rut. They're so transfixed by the pressure groups that got them there in the first place, they're totally paralyzed, and they can't even begin to deal with the issues at hand. And so they do trivia. What do you see coming out of Sacramento these days? So-and-so, they pass this bill, does this. It's trivia. It's junk. They cannot do the big stuff. It cannot be done. And we have to create a system in which we invest, give people power to act, authority to act, and hold them accountable. Otherwise, we're just going to continue spiraling down.
Dan, I believe we also have a comedian in our midst. The next question is, it sounds like we should all pack up and leave California. Where do you suggest we go?
Well, you know, a lot of people have. You know, the people moved to Nevada, did not pay their state income taxes, which are among the highest in the country, or they go to Idaho or someplace like that. I don't know where you should go. I like California. I think it's a fascinating place. I think it's, if nothing else, you're just watching a moment of history here. There's no place like this place anywhere. And what happens here is indicative of what's going to happen to the rest of the country down the line, both good and bad, whether it's development of new technology, good, or falling into the governmental abyss, bad. But California is always out there in front, even on the bad stuff. And so it's an absolutely fascinating place to watch, and the weather's good.
We have a number of questions, Dan, with regards to the budget and how to solve it. The first being, like President Obama, when he took office, the new governor will be starting with a crippled state economy, which you've outlined. What would you suggest would be a good first step to gaining the public's trust and getting California back on track?
I would advise the next governor to do one thing, and that is to absolutely be brutally honest with the people. Don't offer any false hopes. Don't say we're going to get $7 billion from the federal government or some ridiculous thing like that. Don't promise to cut taxes like Arnold Schwarzenegger did on his first day in office and then turn right around with a month later and say we need to borrow $15 billion because we can't pay off our short-term loans. I mean, you can't do that kind of stuff in the long run. He sowed the seeds of his own demise when he did that sort of stuff. You have to be absolutely brutally honest and say the only way we can balance this budget is to do X, Y, and Z, and nobody's going to like it, and it's the only thing that you can do. If you start out with pie in the sky, the way Arnold Schwarzenegger did, you start out in this fantasy world, which he's still in, judging by his last State of the State message, you're just going to go down the tubes because reality bites. And there's a brutal, gritty reality about California's civic crisis. And the next governor would be gaining a lot of credibility in my eyes, and I think in the eyes of a lot of people, they just say, we have that. That's the reality of it, and these are what we're going to have to do to try to climb out of it.
Next question with regards to the budget, following along those same lines, is what do you think are the three most critical fixes to the structural governance in California?
Well, I don't know about the three most critical, because I really do think you need to start with a clean sheet of paper and design. I mean, and not only the state government, the local governments as well. What's magic about 58 counties? We haven't changed the county boundaries in this state since 1907 when Imperial County broke away from San Diego. And that's illogical. We have five county supervisors in Alpine County with 1,200 people, and we have five county supervisors in Los Angeles County with 10 million people. I mean, give me a break. This doesn't make any sense. We have these bifurcated responsibilities between the state and the local government. They kick each other back and forth, back and forth, back and forth all the time. The schools, same way, back and forth, back and forth. I don't know, I'm not going to give you the definitive answer in terms of exact structure. I would say authority and accountability. That's the two things you have to always keep in mind. Empower people to make decisions. Don't hamstring them. Don't elect them to office to fix things, and then don't let them fix them. And then, whatever they do, whether they succeed or fail, they should be accountable for the outcome. This passing the buck stuff is corrosive. It just corrodes, and it corrodes public confidence. It corrodes performance. Accountability and authority are what we need to reinstitute this in the system.
Thank you, Dan. Along the same lines with regards to budget, talking about propositions and initiatives, there seems to be many like Prop 13 or Prop 98 that have designed specific purpose in mind for spending and adding to the budget debacle. Can you talk about the effect of such propositions?
Yeah, they do. And they if I ever write another book about California politics, it's going to be called Unintended Consequences. Because that's what they deal with all the time. Not only the unintended consequences of something like Proposition 13 or Proposition 98, but the unintended consequences of what happens when they interact with one another. And let me give you one small example of it. Redevelopment agencies, which many cities have, probably Santa Clara has one too, they can keep the property taxes, the incremental property taxes from redevelopment areas. Those property taxes, in other words, don't go into the common pot that goes to counties and schools and everything. But that predates Proposition 13. Then Proposition 13 comes along and says property taxes, however, will be limited to 1% of value. So that put a cap on the total amount of property taxes. But those redevelopment agencies still get to keep their incremental part of that 1% and not share it with other local governments. And then Proposition 98 comes along and says each school district is guaranteed a certain amount, calculated amount of money, and they get some of it from the property taxes, but whatever they don't get from the property taxes, the state has to give them. And what that, when you put it all in the hopper, what it means is because you have the interactive, the redevelopment law, Proposition 13 and Proposition 98, it means the state of California has to give schools an extra $2 billion a year to make up for the property taxes that the cities keep in redevelopment areas. Unintended consequences. Nobody set out to create that. That's the unintended consequence. And this is what happens. The unintended consequence of Proposition 13 is not so much the capped taxes. As a matter of fact, property taxes have grown faster over the last 30 years than either state income taxes or sales taxes, a little known fact. They've gone up 800%, and state revenues have only gone up 500%. The real effect of Proposition 13 is something that was never in the proposition, one of those unintended consequences. It shifted authority over schools and local governments to the state and let the state start dictating to these other units of government how they should spend the money because the state controls all the money. So it corroded the atmosphere, the relationships, and it resulted in periodic raids on county government and city government coffers by the state when it got in budget trouble, all these things. None of it was intended by Proposition 13, but it was the unintended consequence. So what we really need to do before we pass all these ballot measures is try to dope out, like that energy deregulation thing I mentioned, what is the worst-case scenario? What's the downside risk? What are the ramifications of this thing? What new elements is it creating? Because we always find that they do, and then they interact with one another and create more, add to the mess, this unaccountable mess that we have in Sacramento. That redevelopment thing is just a small part of it, but that's $2 billion a year of that gap in state finances is because of these three things interacting with one another over a period of decades, none of which was intended. Anyone else?
Dan, along the lines of unintended consequences, we have a question. Jerry Brown, when governor of California, signed a bill allowing the unionization of the public employee workforce.
Yes.
What, in your view, has been the public policy outcome or the effect on the system of this legislation?
Another wonderful unintended consequence. I was there when they did it, and I heard the arguments for it. Well, this merely equates public employees with those in the private sector, gives them the same rights. But there were unintended consequences of it. Unintended consequences is that the relationship between public officials and unions of public employees is not the same kind of relationship as occurs in the private sector. In the private sector, both parties come to the bargaining table as in a kind of an arm's length sort of relationship, both of them trying to make a deal that is works out for the company, for the employer, in terms of their bottom line, and also works out for the employees. In public relationship, the public relationship is completely different. They help elect the people they're negotiating with. And this distorts the whole system then of collective bargaining. There is no collective bargaining, for all intents and purposes. It's merely a political deal of some kind. These contracts are not really negotiated in the same way that they do it in private sector, because there is no bottom line to the thing. And they're helping elect the people they're negotiating with that approve these contracts, plus the fact the public employee unions have the power to go around the contract process entirely and put measures into law that supersede the contracts. If, indeed, the public employees had the same relationship with the public employer as they do in private, I have no problem with it. But when you have all these other elements into it, it creates a different kind of situation. What you really have as a practical result of it, if you combine public employee collective bargaining with term limits and with gerrymandered legislative districts, what it really means as a practical matter is that the public employee unions own the legislature, period. And they shouldn't own the legislature, just as the Southern Pacific Railroad shouldn't have owned the legislature a century ago. But they own the legislature. They're satisfied with the status quo because they can control any, they can control virtually all Democratic primary elections in the legislature, and that is tantamount to being elected because of gerrymandered districts. Unintended consequences of three seemingly unrelated things, collective bargaining, gerrymandered districts, term limits, create a logjam situation, an unhealthy situation, rather than having this arm's length bargaining situation. And I'm a person, I'm not opposed to labor. I've been part of labor unions. I voted to strike. But in the public sector, it's not a healthy relationship at all. And it corrodes the process of governing. Let me give you an example. 10 years ago, Gray Davis signed a bill that converted in-home health care workers, we know who we're talking about, IHSS it's called, from independent contractors subsidized by the state into employees of counties, created instantaneously 300,000 new union members for SEIU and other unions. Completely altered the whole relationship of the state to the IHSS program. It's one of the fastest growing programs. We have 400,000 recipients of IHSS services in California, 300,000 caregivers, most of whom are related to the people they're caring for, but are still unionized workers employed by the counties. It's a not a good situation. It has distorted the whole situation by that act. And it's one of those manifestations, one of those unintended consequences. It's one of those things that contributes. It's been the fastest growing program in state government in the last 10 years. And it's one of those things that contributes to our budget problems. You just don't have an objective, arm's-length relationship when public employees are dealing with state legislators whom they elected in the first place. It's not a good relationship.
And a question following up on that is, who do you think is the most popular, or I'm sorry, not popular, but the most active and influential public employee union? Would it be CTA? Would it be Correctional Peace Officers Association?
A few years ago, I would say it was the CCPOA, the Correctional Peace Officers Association, or the Guards, as they don't like to be called. They were one of the few groups. I wrote a book about lobbying some years ago, a decade or so ago, and said that the CCPOA, the California Teachers Association, and the Indian Gambling Tribes were the three interest groups in the Capitol that never lost. They never, ever lost. And that's not true anymore. The tribes still do pretty well, but the CCPOA hasn't been doing so well in recent years, mostly because they've been very mutually antagonistic with Arnold Schwarzenegger. And even the CTA is not doing as well as it once did, simply because the budget crisis has affected them in ways that they didn't anticipate. But I still say, you know, in relative terms, the CTA and the Prison Guards Union are probably the most influential unions. The SEIU, among other things, health care workers and things, has kind of risen in recent years because it's become so powerful in Los Angeles. And so much of the legislative membership comes from Los Angeles. It's very, very powerful in Los Angeles.
Again, for those on radio, we are joined today by Dan Walter, Sacramento Bee political columnist. Another question we have is Senator Abel Maldonado's confirmation hearing is going to be taking place later today. What are your thoughts on the governor's appointment of Maldonado, the hearing, and the future impact to both the GOP and the Democratic leadership?
It's one of those things that nobody outside of Sacramento cares about, basically. Because it really doesn't, if it doesn't matter who the governor is, it means even less who the lieutenant governor is. I mean, somebody once wrote, and I've never been able to improve on this observation, so I've quoted it several times, that the job of the lieutenant governor is to wake up in the morning, open a newspaper, find out whether the governor is still alive, and if the governor is still alive, find a service club to address that day. And that's about it. That's really about all the lieutenant governor does. He waits around for the governor to die or resign or something. it has no, the office has no substantive duties whatsoever. So this whole exercise of John Garamendi going to Congress and Maldonado being nominated is all an inside the Capitol sort of situation, and it only means something. He would be confirmed in a nanosecond, except it impacts the makeup of the Senate, because if he's confirmed, then his seat is vacant, then you have a special election, then the question is whether the Democrats will be able to take a special election, or maybe they should wait for him to be termed out and go to the special election, because they're worried the Republican might win a special election, but the Democrat would have a better chance in a regular election if he was termed out, and blah, blah, blah. So it's all that kind of stuff, plus the whole idea, and then you get into the thing of it's a Latino Republican, and the Democrats don't want Latino Republicans to come, you know, start surging upwards. And I mean, it's all that kind of inside the Capitol stuff. In reality, it doesn't make a tinker's damn worth of difference.
Thank you, Dan. Well, unfortunately, we have reached the point in our program. We have time for just one last question.
All right.
So given you have written over 6,000 articles about...
Actually, over 7,000 now.
Over 7,000. Almost 50 years and almost 7,000 articles about California politics. Do you have a favorite article that you wrote about an issue or a person?
Well, I wrote a lot of columns about Jerry Brown that were a lot of fun to write about. I guess... Oh, it's hard to remember 7,000 columns, but... I tell you, I will remind you, and it does involve Jerry Brown since he's running for governor again. I'll mention this. It's at least one of my favorites. Right after Proposition 13 passed in 1978, the library lobby, believe it or not, there is such a thing, got the legislature to pass a bill giving some extra money. It's not an awful lot of money. It was like $30 million or something to libraries, to support libraries in the wake of Proposition 13 because they were shutting down. He vetoed the bill, saying the state could not afford this. He was in his Jerry Jarvis mode at the time. He was declaring himself to be a born-again tax cutter. In fact, the state was cutting its own taxes at the time after Prop 13. But he signed a bill, almost simultaneously signed another bill, giving a $30 million a year break, tax break to the horse racing industry. So I wrote a column pointing that anomaly out. And I was really, the column was interesting, and it was kind of fun, because you always like to catch politicians being hypocritical. It's one of the real fun, it's what keeps you coming back every day to do that. But really, I was very proud of the headline, which I also wrote. It says, "Millions for bookies, nothing for books." Jerry did not like that column. This is one of the reasons I like to have him back, because I could just put the needle in just a little bit more. Because I, among the things I have kept all these years is a whole big, it's not a box, it's really a kind of a large briefcase full of all the old Jerry Brown stuff. So I can go back and look what he did on something and bug the hell out of him. But that's one of my favorite columns, mostly because of the headline, "Millions for Bookies, Nothing for Books."
Well, Dan, thank you. And I hope you all enjoy today's program brought to you by the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley and National Semiconductor. Again, we'd like to thank Dan Walters, Sacramento Bee political columnist, our audience here in Santa Clara, and those of you joining us via radio. And once again, I'd like to congratulate the Commonwealth Club as it celebrates its 107th year. And now the meeting of the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley is adjourned.
Thank you.